Welcome back to iGen Politics. This is a podcast that makes politics engaging and relevant for all generations. This is Victor Rashi.
And I'm Jill Wine Banks. And today's hashtag, Jill's Pin, is a domino that is a 4 and a 5, standing for our 45th president, who we'll be discussing today on our podcast, because our guest is someone who brought a case against Donald Trump and Donald Trump University.
For Donald Trump's entire life, people have tried to hold him accountable from the 1970s until he was elected president in 2016. Donald Trump and his businesses were involved in over 4,000 legal cases in U.S. federal and state courts, including battles with casino patrons, million-dollar real estate lawsuits, personal defamation lawsuits, and over 100 business tax disputes. And now there are more. But time and time again, Trump somehow makes his way out. But things seem to be changing, though. E. Jean Carroll succeeded in both of her defamation suits against Donald Trump, resulting in judgments of more than $88 million. A verdict amount is pending in New York court and could be $370 million in a case where he has already been found liable. And the walls are closing in on him and many other investigations and pending criminal trials today.
But today we're going to talk about something that happened before E. Jean Carroll, and that's another successful suit against Trump. So let's get into what we're talking about, and that is we're talking to the lead prosecutor on a Trump University case. Tristan Snell handled the Trump University fraud case at the investigative stage. He was an assistant attorney general to New York State Attorney General, and today he is the founder and managing partner of Main Street Law, and a content creator on Instagram, Threads, TikTok, and Twitter. He has a new book called Taking Down Trump, 12 Rules for Prosecuting Donald Trump by Someone Who Did It Successfully. So we're very excited to be talking to Tristan Snell today. Tristan, it's great to have you here. Thanks for joining us now.
Thanks, happy to be here.
And I want to get right to your book, which is about your case against Trump and his Trump University. The very name Trump University was, of course, a complete fraud because it wasn't a university and it didn't deliver what it promised, which to me sounds like the Trump presidency. But before we get to that, I want to talk to you about the book and its structure. And it's an unusual structure. So I wanted to talk about how you decided to make it 12 rules for successful prosecution.
Yeah, the kicker is that I wanted to really make this a reference guide and a citizen's guide. This is, you know, certainly I'm trying to speak to other lawyers, whether they just have an interest in this or if they actually do think that they might be wanting to try to take on Donald Trump or someone like him, because this is not just about Donald Trump. But I also designed this to be an accessible citizen's guide for everybody to understand the role that we have to play as private citizens. That's a big part of it. And then another part is to break this apart so that folks get more of an understanding of the inner workings of bringing a big case like this, because I think there's a lot of understanding that I think would be better for us to all have regarding how some of these big cases work. Even when they are working, they're slow and clunky and take forever. But we also have to understand how to tell the difference between this is taking forever because it's a big case versus this is taking forever because something's wrong, someone's chickening out, there's a delay, there's a lack of resources, something else, so that we can tell the difference and we can understand when we need to be patient and let the process play out, and when we need to actually start letting our voices be heard and be a constituency for justice. Let's shift to talk about Trump University, because that is such a sort of core element of your book and part of Taking Down Trump. And so, you know, I suspect probably not many people are familiar with the inner workings of that case and what went down. So I'd love to have you just start by telling our audience about Trump University, what it was doing, what the case was about, and maybe some of sort of who the victims were in this case.
Sure. So this is really the first and only book that dives into all of this and gives kind of the inside scoop of what really happened inside the AG's office. And by pulling back the curtain here, I'm also hoping to
again, give people an understanding of what does it look like on the inside of one of these big cases. And sometimes the reason why it's not moving is because something's gone wrong, and it shouldn't be. Like, there's nothing wrong with the merits of the case. There's something else wrong. And I think that's one of the key things with telling the tale here. So to begin at the beginning, yes, Trump University was not a licensed university. It wasn't a licensed school at all. So its very existence and operation was illegal under New York state law. And then on top of that, the entire thing was just a series of bait and switches. So the whole thing was, we're going to teach you the real estate tricks of Donald Trump that the experts and elites don't want you to know. I mean, it's a standard right-wing grift, or sort of, you know, fraudster grift. We're going to teach you these secrets that other people don't want you to know. But they were supposedly Donald Trump's secrets. And they were supposedly, it was supposedly Donald Trump's curriculum, Donald Trump's handpicked instructors. None of that was true. Then when you got there, you paid $1,500 for a 3-day session that was supposed to teach you everything you needed to know about real estate, to start investing in real estate, to start like flipping houses. And instead, you got there, and then they spent the whole time scaring you into thinking that you were not ready and that you needed a mentor. Then they would upsell you to these really expensive $15,000, $25,000, $35,000 programs. And that is where Trump University took in the bulk of its money. A lot of people, to pay for all of this, they emptied out their life savings. They got into crippling credit card debt. One person that I had talked to lost their home over it. Who were these people? They were super fans of Trump. They were really into The Apprentice. Trump University was specifically targeting middle-age and middle-income folks. We actually saw it in their playbook. They were deliberately going after folks that were 50 to 70 years old, who had a household income of or a personal income of like $35,000 to $65,000 a year. And this was, mind you, this was during the crash. This was like 2007 to 2010. So they were going after folks who their stock market portfolio, if they had any stock at all, had just taken a massive dip. The value of their home, if they owned a home, just took a massive dip. And a lot of people were extremely anxious that they weren't going to be able to afford to retire. And that's who they were going after. They were finding these folks who felt very upset and worried and insecure, and they preyed on them. It was extremely predatory. And these folks wanted to be entrepreneurs. They wanted to live the American dream. They wanted to be their own boss. They wanted to make more money. And Trump used all of that. He and his people used all of that and used it to pick their pockets. So that's what that was. And then in terms of the case itself, you know, I can go on in greater detail, and I go on a great deal into great detail about this in the book. But a lot of it is the tale of how we almost didn't bring the case about 5 different times because there was a lot of timidity and uncertainty with the top brass, especially the AG at the time, Eric Schneiderman. He did his best to try to not bring the case on many, many occasions. And then I try to use this as a case study to show how can you actually get an elected official, elected prosecutor like that to move? How can we be the ones that create a movement for justice and accountability to get these folks to actually do their jobs? We need to hold them accountable so that they hold the bad guys accountable.
So we will get into more detail about, because that's one of your first rules for proceeding. Yep. And you kind of accused Schneiderman of having accepted money from Trump, which affected his decisions whether to prosecute.
We don't know. We don't know what happened there, but something was going on. Something funny was going on there, it looks like. We just don't know what happened.
Exactly. But I want to ask a series of quick fundamental questions just so that the audience understands, and that I do too, because it, as I was reading and preparing for talking to you, I was like, okay, so you worked for the New York Attorney General, who has civil jurisdiction. So first of all, this was not a criminal case, correct?
Right. That's correct. This was a civil enforcement action, a civil prosecution. Yes. Right.
And so what damages were you seeking and how much did you win? And did the case ever go to trial, or was it settled before trial? And I have a series more after that, but that's
sure.
Asking
sure, sure, sure. So there was about $42 million worth of revenue that had been taken from the victims. We were seeking all of that plus penalties. Then the case never did go to trial. Along with our case, along with the case that had been brought in parallel as a private civil class action in federal court in San Diego, we had a global settlement that was announced in November of 2016, shortly after Trump won the 2016 election, and the case settled for $25 million. So that resulted in the consumers who put in claims at the end got a bit over 90% of their money back.
Well, that's a good outcome. And I want to just point out that people may not realize that the work that goes into getting a settlement is the same work that you would do for a trial, that you need to present a strong, convincing case to make someone settle, even if it's Donald Trump who says, I only settled because I was too busy as president-elect to pay any attention to this. So I'm assuming that you had built a pretty significant amount of evidence, as did, there were two class actions, if I understand correctly. And they had to build up a case too. So settlement is not getting away with anything. It means you did your work in order to get the evidence gathered. And I think that's an important thing for people to understand. And of course, he was only president-elect because he caused delay. And that seems to be a theme of all the things going on now. So can you talk about some of the delay that he caused as to why this dragged on from the time it got to your desk to the time it got to settlement discussions?
Sure. So a couple of things, there were all of the delays within the office to bring the case in the first place. That had to do with Schneiderman predominantly. Some of it had to do with Trump stonewalling, and we had to work extra hard to go get the documents. There's a whole part of the book that's really about that. The way I would break it out is this way. I started at the office in October of 2011. I would say that by the summer of 2012, we had built our case in chief. We'd gotten the evidence that we needed. Everything was pretty much in order. We could have filed that summer. It got held up and stopped purely for internal political reasons from the summer of 2012 until the spring and into the summer of 2013. It finally got greenlit at that point. We filed our case in August of 2013. In a civil enforcement or civil prosecution action like that, you actually go get all of your evidence at the beginning of the case, then you file with all of your evidence. And you're effectively doing what amounts to kind of a complaint crossed with a motion for a summary judgment. At least that's the way the New York procedure works. It's called a special proceeding. And then at that point we had, then what happened? Well, Trump did a motion to dismiss. He did gob up things by bringing up this whole statute of limitations issue that we had to deal with in that matter. That was not entirely his doing. He did manage to seize upon the one thing that he could grab at that was that had any legal merit at all. I mean, I would argue that it didn't really have that much, but we had to go win a statute of limitations issue up on appeal. So we had to take it up to the Intermediate Appellate Court in New York. That took forever. We then got a victory on that in March of 2016, at which point the judge said, okay, we're going to trial. Trump said, not so fast. I'm going to be the Republican nominee for president. I can't do this. And the judge, unfortunately, bought it. And instead of going on trial in April or May of 2016, it got moved to post-Thanksgiving 2016 so that it would be after the election. Both our case and the Makeff case, which was the first and larger of the class action matters, were both slated to go to trial right in November, December of 16. And that was what prompted, we were going to win those trials. I think we were going to win our trial. I think they had a good shot to win theirs. And that's why Trump ended up having to settle. But that's where a lot of the different, there were a lot of flavors of delay there between 2011 and 2016, but that's where it all came from.
This sounds awfully reminiscent of what's happening right now. I want to ask you if you think, did his lawyers and sort of your experience behave in the same way that we're seeing his attorneys act right now? What was Trump behaviors like? And sort of walk us through sort of what that experience was like. Because as you're talking about this, it sounds so much like what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, that's right. It very much is. Throughout the book, I try to draw the parallels between, I talk about the Trump University thing, but then I try to thread in all of the other cases that are going on now and use those as examples of where we're seeing some of these same phenomena. So the book is really more, in a lot of ways, it's probably more about the cases going on currently than it is about Trump U. But I think the Trump U example is a good case study to be able to point to, because we know how it ended, right? With the ones we're dealing with now, we don't know how they're going to end. So we don't know if it's going right or it's going wrong or whatever. At least with Trump U, we can look at something and say, okay, it dealt with obstacles A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and it actually turned out to work. It came out okay in the end. So what does that tell us about what the cases look like today? So yes, toward the tail end of the book and the kind of what I call the going public sections, part three, we get into a couple of the other rules about the sort of clown car of Trump's opposing counsel. That's one chapter, and each rule is a chapter. And then there's another chapter on Trump counterattacking. To answer your question, all of those things that we're seeing today, we saw back then. Trump will definitely roll out kind of a clown car of, it's a rotating cast of attorneys. They come, they go, he promotes them, he benches them, he fires them, he hires them. A lot of them are not the people with the, experience that you would want to have for bringing such a high profile case. Let's just call it that. We get folks like Alina Haba, who, her big prior experience before working with Trump was that she had been the in-house counsel for a parking garage company. And now she's, defending him against all these very high profile matters. And you get what you get when you sort of bring in these folks that their rates might not be the same high rates of, say, like a very large famous law firm. Trump likes to do a lot of things on the cheap, and he's notoriously cheap that way. Always has been. He got it from his father, and I think it shows in how some of these things happen. So what does he do? He gets these folks that they're not necessarily going to be the greatest lawyers on the planet. They're certainly not the most expensive lawyers on the planet. They're going to come in and it's do, 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 do. Oh, let's do this distraction. Let's do that distraction. Oh, there's a man breathing fire. Oh, there's elephants. Oh, there's something else. Anything but the law, anything but the evidence. They're going to bring up every diversion, every attack, every whatever they can come up with. And this is what he still does today. And a lot of his briefs actually sound like he wrote them. And I was thinking back and looking back at the briefs from the Trump U case. And I kind of wonder, is he dictating these to the lawyer in long phone calls, and they're like writing them out? Because there's the briefs will go on for 5 pages, 10 pages, and not cite a single case and not cite a single piece of evidence. And it's like, that's not how legal briefs look. Anybody who's ever gone to look at all of these are all online for all of us to see. That's not how they look. A real legal brief is coming up with some kind of basis for every single point you make. That's not how Trump's briefs look like a lot of the time. They look more like a Truth Social post, to be real. So,
except that in all
there's that, and then yeah, exactly. And then there's all the counterattacking. Counterattack the lawyers. Counterattack the go after the judge. Go after the judge's clerk. All of this stuff is he did this back in the Trump University case. He went after the judge in the class action in San Diego. That was the infamous that Mexican judge. Comment that got him into at least a little bit of trouble, but ultimately did him no real damage. But that he went after the judge in that case, and he went after his lawyers went after me. They accused me in a court briefing of fabricating all of the witness testimony, and they said they were going to depose me and get to the truth of the matter. They never did any such thing, and there was no basis for them to do that. We had a lot of brave witnesses who had come forward to give their side of the story. But of course they were going to do that. They had no basis for it, but they were going to do it. And so we see the same things going on today. We see it in how he's attacking Fannie Willis. We see it how he's attacking Tish James, how he's attacking Judge Chutkan, Judge Kaplan, Judge Engoron. Like, the list goes on and on. It's all the same playbook.
You mentioned they were going to depose you. Did you get to depose Donald Trump?
I wish I had. I do wish I had. That's one of my only really big regrets. About, I mean, obviously, it went wonderfully. There's two big things. One is that I wish that we had just won at trial rather than winning because Trump became president. That would have been better. Like, when I got the news, I was actually on my honeymoon. And it was very bittersweet to be getting this news. Gosh. I'm sitting at a hotel pool, and my wife spots this on like the BBC website, and it's like, oh my God, I can't believe it. So all of a sudden, this case that I had worked on is now international news, and I was just floored. But at the same time, I was in this like state of shock because Trump had won the presidency. But the other big regret is that I wish that we'd gotten to depose Trump. We couldn't get approval for that upstairs. And I think it might have been the right move. The thought was our case was really wonderful as it was. So why engage in the whole battle to try to get him in? Because we were probably going to have to. If we had noticed him, he would have not come. And we probably would have needed to go file a motion to compel to get him to come in. And we had already had a whole mess with trying to get the documents. As I describe in the book, and this is really one of the most shocking things that happened in that case and shows the degree to which Trump can intimidate and co-opt people. We filed a motion to compel to enforce our subpoena because they had been stonewalling us and they owed us huge amounts of documents that we never got. And we filed a motion to compel. And Trump's lawyers went so berserk on everybody on our team, and it didn't work by calling my boss, my boss's boss, my boss's boss's boss, but they got to Schneiderman, and the order came from upstairs, pull it back. This is never something that happens. Jill, have you ever heard of anything like this where a government office pulls back a motion like that because they got yelled at by opposing counsel? I mean, just, it's absolutely shocking the degree to which we caved there. It's really horrifying. And nobody knew. It hadn't managed to actually get to the press, so nobody realized that we had humiliated ourselves in this fashion. But I think that's why we never decided to go fight the fight to go get Trump to sit for a deposition. I wish that we had. It would have been fun.
Yeah, I wish you had too, because I would love to hear about it. We in the Watergate case, we didn't get to depose because, of course, it would have been grand jury, not deposition, because it was criminal. But we did actually get to have a sort of a grand jury after the convictions. I had already left the office by then, but there was one grand juror and several of the lawyers who were still at the office who weren't involved in the trial got to interview Richard Nixon. But I just had one more follow-up.
Wow. Yeah, sure.
You had mentioned that Donald Trump does things on the cheap. But another thing about him is he doesn't actually pay people. So he may hire cheap lawyers, but then he doesn't pay them. But it seems from what I've looked at, he didn't pay the $25 million. He got someone else to do it, which is what he's doing now.
That's
right. With his cult members. People who can't afford it are contributing and paying for his lawyers and probably will pay for E. Jean Carroll's judgment, et cetera. But am I correct that it was... the settlement was paid by a hotel billionaire in Las Vegas, not by Donald Trump. Is that true?
I know he didn't pay it. He definitely borrowed the money. I thought part of it was there was a lender that had been lending to him a bunch during that time period called Ladder Capital that I think was also in on it, but that might not have been the right payment. But yes, he definitely borrowed the money. In the same way that then when he had to pay the E. Jean Carroll money from last year and he had to pay a tax bill that had come up for $29 million that I think probably resulted from one of his audits going the wrong way, he
had to, he took that money from the Trump Organization in violation of Judge Engoron's court order and without telling the court monitor. Wow. So of all the places where he could have gotten money from to come up with that $40 million that he took from the, he took it from the one pot of money that he wasn't allowed to because the judge had said no, and the court order and the court monitor was supposed to be like, no, 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 you're not allowed to move those assets. So I think that tells you something about his liquidity.
Yeah, it does. I mean, my information comes from Wikipedia. I was hoping to confirm it, but Wikipedia says that a man named Ruffin, who is this owner of a Las Vegas hotel, who admits that he paid $28 million, and the judgment was $25 million to Donald Trump, but he says it was back fees related to Trump International Hotel and wasn't really to pay off the Trump University. But you know, money's fungible, so if he gave him $28 right. million, it could be where it went. Just saying. But Victor, you had a follow up question.
Well, yeah, I just want to ask you, because you mentioned his attacks on judges right now, Letitia James, you know, and other attorneys and people who are holding him accountable. And I know you wrote a book that covers 12 rules about how people should respond. But if you had to pick one or two of maybe the best lessons that you've learned that judges and attorneys and sort of people who are fighting this case can use to respond to them, what would you say to them? Because it's so vicious and it's so intense.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the rule there, the one that's the most applicable, is all about you cannot, if he's lashing out at you, ignore it, because it means you're on the right track. I think that's rule 11. And I think that's really, really important. He doesn't lash out at people if they haven't scored hit points on him. Right. The reason why he's pissed off is because the other team is scoring. Okay, and then he lashes out. So if he lashes out, you should actually take that as a victory, weirdly, because it shows that you're doing well. One of the best examples of really holding firm and kind of taking a very stoic approach, just continuing to march forward no matter what with these cases, I think you should look no further than E. Jean Carroll, because it's one thing to be a lawyer on a case and have him come after you, even if you're a government lawyer, and then you're sort of, you know, you're worried, you're kind of like out there in a public position. It's another thing entirely when he assaulted her, he defamed her, he was continuing to defame her, and yet she was, you know, she didn't let it show that it was getting to her. She didn't lash back out at him. She kept showing up and being poised and calm and confident going into those courthouses. And she got up and she testified, and she's now spoken about the feeling she had, that she was horribly nervous, that it was just like sickening for her at first, but that once she actually got up there and saw him, that it was like, wait, him, I'm afraid of him. You know, suddenly he became less imposing by being a physical presence as opposed to an abstraction. And she was able to, and I'm sure part of it is that she got prepped very well by her lawyers. She was able to just dial in and just say the things that she needed to say. She kept on her lane. She kept on her facts and her story. And that's what you need to do. You don't let anyone see that it's getting to you. You don't let them show, what am I trying to say? You don't let them see a sweat. You don't want them to see a sweat. You don't want to show that you're rattled. You don't want to show that it's getting under your skin. None of those things. So I think that, I think Tish James has done a good job of this too. I think she's done a good job of, every time Trump attacks her, you know, she sort of brushes it aside and says, like, you know, Donald Trump's attacks don't matter. He did this, this, and this, and he is going to get brought to justice. And that's what you need to be able to do. So that's one of them. I think another one that's very applicable is really about not giving, and this is more true for like a civil case, but don't give in too soon. Like if there is an opportunity to settle, don't take the first thing that comes your way. Don't give too low of an offer.
You know, I think that Michael Cohen did a good job of this. He waited in his case to try to recover some fees that he had paid for Trump long ago, that he was trying to recover. He didn't settle until the eve of trial. Like, he didn't sell, and we don't know how much he got, but I have confidence that, like, Cohen knew how to play the game because he used to be the one that ran that game for Trump. We don't know, but I suspect there was a possibility in there that maybe Carroll could have made that case end sooner. They didn't. They just kept going. Don't, you know, he, regardless of what he says, he will settle, but you need to just, again, hold firm, stick to your facts, stick to your arguments, and keep going, because it's that's really the way to beat him. He's all about shiny, flat. He's all flash and no substance. It's all shiny objects and diversions and distractions and personal destruction. And if you just ignore all of that and just stay focused on the seriousness of the case that you've got, he can't do that. The reason he does all of that other stuff is because he's losing in the courtroom. So he makes it about anything other than losing in the courtroom. But if you just stick to your case, that's how you wear him down.
Yeah, and he keeps saying the same things over and over again in his arguments, as in the immunity,
that's right,
for example. But E. Jean Carroll was an extraordinary person, and Roberta Kaplan, an extraordinary lawyer. So yay for them.
Yep.
But you mentioned that you look at more current cases in your book. And so I wanted to ask you whether you have some predictions about some of the pending cases. We can start with the New York fraud case, which is almost about to be decided, maybe as early, you know, maybe even before this episode is broadcast, it may have been decided. So I hate to ask you a prediction on something that may happen before this is released, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Sure.
What do you think the verdict will be in that? And I don't know, you mentioned Letitia James. Do you know her? And anything more about her case and any of the other, you know, cases that are still pending?
Sure. So I would say that with the New York AG civil fraud case, I think that we're going to see a final number that is somewhere between $200 million and the $370 million that the AG's office is seeking. It's possible that he could go even higher than that. I'm just guessing that he won't. I think that what he's been trying to do is he's taking a firm stance against people just running amok in his courtroom and running amok with this case. He's not just taking a laissez-faire approach that like whatever, anything goes. But at the same time, he's being very careful not to create any issues that can then be a further fodder for an appeal. And so I don't think he's going to go higher than the $370 million. That's just my gut feeling on that. But I think it's going to be in the 200s or 300s in there. And then I think you're going to, you know, that'll immediately get appealed. And then what you're going to, then be that plus the cancellation of the corporate charters. Those are going to be the big issues up on appeal in the New York appellate system, for that matter. And then we may be frustrated by how slow that appeals process is. Unfortunately, we'll have to see about that. So that's that one. And you know, I just to be clear, I don't have any special insight as to Tish or her team. I could make phone calls over there. I don't, because I want to let them do their jobs. They don't want to talk to me. They're very good at not talking to outside people there. So they would just brush me off even if I tried. So I'm not going to try. So I don't have any inside intel there. But in general, of course, I'm a little bit biased. It's my old office. It's a hell of a great group of lawyers, and they're just exceptionally good at putting their heads down and just doing the work. It is a office of workhorses, not show horses. And so and that's part of why I think they've been so good at wearing Donald Trump down, that way. So there's that one. I think that I am hopeful that the DC case is going to get back on track. I think we're going to get SCOTUS to move relatively quickly, is my feeling. It still could be a couple of weeks. I think people could get frustrated, but I believe that case is headed for trial this spring and is going to result in a conviction. I still believe it. maybe I'm going to be dead wrong. I hope not, but that's where I'm at there. And if it gets delayed more, they could sneak in there with the New York hush money case. We've been sleeping on that one, but that case could suddenly go to trial. If the put it this way, if the DC case is looking more like May rather than April, I actually think the New York the hush money case might start trial in late March, and that's a shorter trial.
I just want to say I want to call it instead of hush money case, I want to call it an election interference case.
That is, yes, that's right. And a falsification of business records case. That's exactly right. Again, it was an election interference case because you're absolutely right. Because if those stories had broken at that time, it might have been finally enough to bring him down. I mean, he barely won as it was. So would that have been enough to have swayed some other people to have not voted for him or to have stayed home? You know, we'll never know because he actually did manage to silence those women. I think that case could go in late March, and that case is probably only a month. I don't think that's not a longer trial. It's a relatively open and shut case. I don't even know if it's a month. Like it's a relatively simple fact pattern. There's not that many witnesses. There's not that much evidence. It's actually fairly straightforward. That case will hinge ultimately on how it does on appeal is what's going to happen with that one. You know, and then we'll have to see the Florida case is, of course, just a mess. And the Atlanta case, I want to say this, is that the kicker there with the Atlanta case is that it's not because of what's been going on with the allegations against Fannie Willis. It is entirely because the case was always going to be slow because it's a bigger case. You had 19 defendants originally. You have dozens and dozens of counts. One of the first things the judge said at the first status conference was that, and I don't think he was joking, he said, I don't know if there's a courtroom in Atlanta big enough to hold this trial. The logistics of that matter are why it's slow, not because Fannie Willis needs to go talk to someone at HR. And by the way, I think that has Donald Trump's fingerprints all over it as a classic smear of the lawyer that's going up against him. It's the same kind of stuff he did as far back as 1973 when he was first accused by a government civil enforcement action of discriminating against Black prospective tenants. And Roy Cohn got him off with basically a slap on the wrist. And part of how they did it was that they mercilessly intimidated and bullied and smeared the government lawyer on the other side. So this is a longstanding playbook.
So, you know, I hope every one of those attorneys and judges reads your book, and we hope for the best in these cases and good outcomes. But I want to ask you about how this might translate into the sort of the public, because as we've seen with a lot of his cases, that the public doesn't, or I guess by the public, I mean his supporters, they don't really react in the way that you would expect regular supporters to react if their political candidate got indicted or faced criminal wrongdoing. So I'm wondering what you think about what it might take to get the public and his supporters to see the facts of these cases, and if any of these decisions and outcomes might have an impact on how they see Trump and his behavior?
Yeah, look, that's a good question, Victor. I think the key there is it's a spectrum, right? And so what we need to remember is that you've got your sort of hardcore MAGA people, and they think some of them actually think that he's somehow like divinely sanctioned. Okay. When he goes to New York to go to these courtrooms, they view it as like Christ going to Jerusalem to be crucified. Like that's actually how his hardcore supporters see it, which is just absolutely like mind blowing to me on multiple different levels, but let's just put those folks aside because I don't think they're reachable. Where I have more hope is there's a cluster of folks that supported him in 16. They supported him in 20. They have generally been very pro Trump. They might have a Trump flag or a Trump bumper sticker. They might have the hat, but they're not as hardcore. It's a spectrum. And they're folks who are definitely like really strong Republicans. They're conservative. They did not get a thought in their head that they might vote for Joe Biden in 2020, and they really don't want to vote for Joe Biden this time either. They probably hate Joe Biden, whatever. However, I do believe that there's that cluster there that they're not diehard MAGA, they're diehard Republican and think that Trump is the best leader for the Republican Party, but their opinions are more about their belief in conservatism and in the Constitution than they are about Trump as a cult of personality. And that there's at least some of those people there that they're going to see other people that they respect and have supported, like a Mike Pence or a Mark Meadows or somebody like that, get up on that witness stand and talk about what they saw and what Donald Trump did and how he came within a whisker of overthrowing the 2020 election and keeping himself in the White House regardless of the fact that he lost. And that he was trying to do it through pressuring Pence, through trying to hijack DOJ, through getting the fake electors to deliver fraudulent, forged government documents to Congress, saying that those states had elected Trump when they hadn't. And then, of course, managing to successfully, we have to remember, it is they successfully delayed the certification of the Electoral College votes because the Constitution requires them to be done on that day, and they actually successfully forced it to not happen until early the next morning when they reconvened in the middle of the night and they got it done in the early hours of January 7th. They successfully stopped Congress from meeting that day. All of those things together, I think when people are hearing about them, it will be enough to make some of these people pull the cord and say, you know what, that's it. I'm finally off the bus, because he was trying to subvert the Constitution of the United States. And they may not vote for Joe Biden, but at least maybe they won't vote for Donald Trump, and maybe they'll just stay home. I think there's still a risk that some of those people maybe try to vote for RFK or vote for No Labels or something. But just like, I do believe that there's going to be a certain number of people that have been Trump supporters that are finally going to see what happened here, and they're going to feel a little bit ill about it all, and that maybe that disgust feeling, like, he was in it for himself. He wasn't in it for America. That's the thing that people need to get. You can be a conservative, have all your conservative views. I don't agree with you, but have those views. That's fine. However, the key is that Trump doesn't have those views necessarily either. He is a con man who's in it for himself and isn't in it for you and isn't in it for America. And once even a small number of people that are on his side realize that, it can only be like a few percentage points worth of his support, that's going to make a big, big difference. So that's what I look for as I think about how these cases are going to unfold against the backdrop of the election.
And that might be
a good stop,
except I want to move to a new subject that I personally never thought I would ask about. And that is something that I only signed up for this week. don't know how to use, really, although I'm getting guidance from Victor because it is aimed at his generation. But you have brought the law to TikTok. So I wanted to ask
I've you. I've tried.
Well, I mean, it's more than most of us have done. And so can you talk about that, how you decided to do that and how effective it's been? And, you know, what's your reception been on TikTok?
Yeah, no, it's been a lot of fun. I started doing that about a little over a year ago, and it's been good. I think still have been just kind of in a fun experimental mode of like trying to see what works and what doesn't work. Still trying to kind of like figure out the patterns and things, and you know, try to figure out what's resonating with people, what's resonating with, you know, you're not just really dealing with people, you're also dealing with like how to optimize for an algorithm, like with any other social media platform, or at least with most of them. But it's been fun though. I really believe very firmly though, because I've been, the little secret on my end is that I've been actually in the creator and influencer space since 2014. It's been 10 years now. Up until a couple of years ago, I wasn't making content of my own. I ran a social media platform for about 6 years I worked with a lot of top creators, especially a lot of the folks who were used to be big on Vine. Because that dates back to when I was working on that project, and a lot of the folks who've been on YouTube for a long time, and a lot of those people have then moved on to Instagram or to TikTok. And of course, YouTube's still going strong. So I knew what to do. I just hadn't done it myself. And then I've gotten a lot of really wonderful help from folks that I've been working with, and gotten a lot of good pointers from other folks. So it's been a really great experience. But I will just say, I feel extremely firmly that all of these types of digital media, whether we're doing these podcasts, and then they're also going to live on YouTube and Facebook and so forth, or we're doing things on TikTok or Instagram, or I still call it Twitter. I'm not going to change that name in my head. It's still Twitter to me, or Threads, or whatever else comes along after. These forms of digital media, and I think especially the video pieces of it, are going to be where this is what's going to decide hearts and minds in the public arena, in politics, on a go-forward basis in the years to come. You know, we're going to get to a point where it's going to be TikTok or Insta that makes or unmakes a presidential candidate, in the same way that in 1960 television helped win the election for JFK over Nixon. We're going to have those kind of moments coming up here on social media that will make or break national candidates. It's only a matter, it's coming, if it's not already here. I think that it still doesn't feel that way, because a lot of the sort of political actors, most of them aren't on there, or if they are on there, they're not doing it very well. That's going to change. I think we see the vanguard of what's coming. If you want to see what the future of politics is going to look like on media, it's on your phone, and it's folks like, say, AOC. Like, that's where it's going, because it's folks who truly understand how to use that digital media and understand that it's not just TV, but on a smaller device. It's a different feel, because you're talking directly to the audience. It's a lot more authentic. It's a lot more intimate. And the same rules don't necessarily apply. And I have found it to be immensely, fun and awesome to do. And I really feel like this is where things are going. So those of us that care about these issues and want to reach an audience, it's super important that we're all on there and that we're mastering these new technologies.
So I just will have a quick follow-up. You said that like 10 years ago, you were running this thing, social media thing. That was why you were in the AG's office, though. How were you doing?
I actually left the AG's office in June of 2014, and left to go do this startup. So I wasn't there for the settlement. I built the whole case in chief, worked and handled getting through our motion to dismiss, and got we basically won it, except for the statute of limitations issue. Then the appellate bureau went and won that appeal. But yeah, I left then. And to be clear, my colleagues thought I was crazy, absolutely nuts. And they twisted my arm and got me to stay for an extra 6 weeks to help finish the briefing on the motion to dismiss. And they were really trying to see if they could get me to not do this, because they thought I was crazy and that I was flushing my career down the toilet. And in some ways I was, like going and doing a startup, like, what the hell are you doing? The thing is, and ultimately we actually did really well with it for a while, but it didn't end up working out. But the things that I learned about how to do digital media that I never would have learned being like a, sort of late Gen Xer, I think it really served me well. So now I'm, able to go and do things like Insta or TikTok and Twitter. And it taught me a lot. So that it was a weird left turn in the context of my legal career, but I actually think that it's proven to be something that was really super valuable. So sometimes things have a funny way of working out.
So is that what law is? You're not practicing law, you're actually doing this?
No. So the startup thing was called Snacked, and we had a good run, but it didn't end up working out. We were out of money, and then COVID happened. So that was sort of the end of that. And we had a few minutes there where we were being talked about as kind of a successor to Vine, and we made it into the top 50 of the App Store. And we did some cool stuff. We worked with a lot of really awesome creators. That was fun. But no, Main Street Law is my my practice today. So I got that off the ground a few years ago now. We're coming up on sort of the third anniversary of kind of rolling that out. And nope, that's been my practice that I built from a solo practice up into now we've got about 14 people involved and folks coast to coast and working with a lot of really awesome tech companies and digital media clients. So it's great.
So I have a couple of questions about your being on TikTok, and we'll get into President Biden's announcement that he's on TikTok now soon. But can you just give us a little insight on maybe, because you said you've been in this creator space for a while. Can you talk about what your process is like for turning these really complex legal issues into these sort of entertaining bite-sized pieces of content and what that's like for you?
Guys, did you get that? Victor just said it was entertaining. That's a seal. I'm gonna put that out there on all my things. It's just like entertaining.
Well, it's why you do so well. It's not just me.
it's been going pretty well. I've been pretty happy with it. So, look, I think the process is, look, there's certain things where it's like, okay, it starts off with like, oh, that tweet did really well. I'm gonna come up with a video that kind of hits that same point. Sometimes it's that I actually come up with the video idea first and then I turn it into a tweet later. We're still trying to figure out what resonates and doesn't resonate. Sometimes the Trump legal news works and then I try to kind of explain what's going on with that, but it's sort of a combo explanation and I'm usually making some kind of more sort of advocacy point. Like I definitely have a strong pro-democracy point of view on all of this Trump stuff. And then when I get into issues that aren't Trump related, you know, I have a very, you know, pro progressive, you know, pro consumer protection, anti-corruption, anti-fraud position across a range of different issues. And so I end up talking about a lot of other things as well. And I'm trying to make sure, you know, I just had this book launch. And so I've been talking Trump like all day, every day. We're now trying to work on working back in some other topics that aren't Trump related because, and I think this is interesting. It's especially true for TikTok. It's also true for Insta. Victor, I'm curious to get your take on this. You know, I think there's a great degree to which the younger audience is not really that as interested in, it's not like they support Trump. But they're not necessarily as interested in, they don't necessarily want to hear about Trump every day. They don't really want to hear about Biden every day either. They do want to hear about the issues that really, really matter to them. That's at least my take. And some of my best content has been things that didn't mention Trump or anything like that at all. But it talked about gun violence. It talked about student loans. It talked about LGBTQ rights. It talked about the climate. Things like that. And I think that that's one of the, and then I think consumer protection is a big one too. Protecting small businesses is another thing where I'm going to be talking a lot about that coming up. But so it's interesting. I think the key is to have a blend because I think that the issues in a lot of ways are more important to a lot of folks as opposed to the candidates who seem sort of like, you know, they're literally from a different generation. At least now, like we might see Biden on TikTok and maybe he'll actually reach some people that way. But I feel like there's more of a focus on issues and less on the candidates to some degree. And I'm trying to make sure that that's part of our blend of content that we push out, even though I also want to make sure that I'm highlighting when there's an important issue having to do with one of these cases where I really feel like people need to know, like, okay, this is what happened. This is why it's important. And this is my take on it. And, you know, and trying to do all of that in like 30 to 60 seconds is a challenge, but it's doable. It is very doable. And I find that it is a medium that can work very well for getting that kind of content out.
I absolutely agree with you that I think that, you know, the most young people I think resonate mostly with issues rather than Trump. And I think most people just sort of know what Trump is about. And I think that's part of the reason why not many of my friends talk about, you know, the ins and outs of all the legal cases. I think that all of us understand that he is a threat to democracy. And I think the choice is clear to them. It's now just about how do we sell all the President Biden has done and Democrats have done to get them excited to vote in this election. I think that's the challenge. But maybe one last question for you in that same vein is, now that President Biden is on TikTok, do you feel like he should focus more on those issues as opposed to giving people some sort of insight into who he is or humanizing himself and making him appear like an empathetic and I guess real human, or should he lean into those issues?
I think he should do a little bit of both. You know, I think that it would be good to sort of see him as he needs to talk about his kids and his grandkids. He should not try to be cool. That is a bad idea. But he should play like he can be. It's okay for him to be a grandpa. He is a grandpa. Like, just be that, but be like the grandpa or great uncle that people really love having around for holidays. Like, be that guy. Do that a little bit, and then talk about the issues that I think are really going to resonate and hopefully drive people to the polls. Talk about the very threat that right-wing Republicans present to voting rights for younger folks at all, because you literally have multiple different voices on the Republican side saying that the voting age should be raised to 25 or 26. You have folks saying that it's become a very popular message on right-wing message boards to say that there should be some kind of test for voters, that voting should be a privilege, not a right. That's literally something that's become part of the bloodstream of the right wing. So we need to talk about that too. We need to talk about reproductive rights. Like, those are the, there's a number of issues that I think he needs to emphasize there. And I think that will go a long way toward making people realize that what they're hearing about Biden through the mainstream media is, and this gets into the why social media at all, because then you get to talk directly to people as opposed to have it be intermediated through the mainstream media, where the mainstream media folks are just going to go through this whole thing of like, they want to try to make it look fair. So they're going to basically just like take shots at Biden whenever they can. And the main thing that they're hammering on is, oh, he's old, he's old, he's old. Oh, he's in trouble. And I think for him to actually talk directly to people, the more he does that, the more people are going to realize like, hey, he's actually gotten a lot done. And I agree with him on most of the issues I care about. I agree with him. So, okay. I think that sounds pretty good. So we'll see. It's tricky, but I think that if you don't get in there, you're really feeding that territory to folks who might not be spreading the right information. And we need to be in there making sure that we're amplifying these things and making sure that the pro-democracy forces are louder and with a better message.
So, Tristan, you obviously know a lot more about TikTok than I do. So I hate to sort of disagree, but the reason I went on TikTok was to see the Biden content that had been put on. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm disagreeing is because he was cool in those things. And I think he can look cool, and maybe should keep on looking cool. The lasers coming out of his eyes, playing into the conspiracy theory of the right wing about Taylor Swift, and answering Super Bowl questions rather than having done a Super Bowl ad. I mean, that's targeting, you know, Victor's generation, and that's important. Yeah. They're a big voting block, and being cool to them is, I think it's cool to be cool to them. So I don't know. What do you think?
No, I agree with you there. I think that his team has been very good at playing with the memes. I just don't want, if he just has like a very simple line where he's just like, you know, don't wake up Dark Brandon, you know, whatever he did with the coffee cup, like that stuff works. I just, you know, if he tries too hard, it's going to be problematic. I think they've done a good job of like playing with the memes without sort of putting him in positions where he's not going to shine. I thought he did a good job with that stuff the other day. And honestly, the sports thing was great. It was definitely part of how I felt like President Obama really was a relatable person to a lot of middle America, was the fact that he actually is genuinely a giant sports nut.
you know, his whole thing where he would do the March Madness bracket every year, which I think he still does, even though he's no longer president. Although somehow Donald Trump, I think, still thinks Barack Obama is president, but that's another story. The football thing, though, I mean, yeah, why not capitalize on the fact that suddenly a younger audience tuned into the Super Bowl for the first time in a generation, because that's pretty much what just happened. Like, the football numbers had looked dreadful with younger people for a long, 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 long time until this year. And then all of a sudden it's just like, ta-da. So it's amazing. It's amazing what difference a year can make.
Or that Taylor Swift can make is what you really mean to say.
Well, of course, that's really the kicker.
Yes. So definitely. Tristan, thank you so much for coming on. We enjoy this immensely. And we hope everyone will check out your book. We'll include it in our show notes. And we look forward to hopefully next time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Victor. Thanks, Jill.
Thank you, everyone, for watching or listening to this episode of iGen Politics. We hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back next week with another episode of iGen Politics. But in the meantime, you can subscribe or follow us wherever you follow your podcast. And be sure to leave us a rating there so you don't miss an episode. You can also watch us on YouTube, where you can see Jill's pins. So find us there or wherever you listen. Thank you, everyone, for watching, and we'll see you next week.